Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Paige Feldman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Stuart. This is really exciting. I love talking about movies.
And we're going to do, in a kind of progression, on literally a progression, on a previous show I did called Five Great Rom-Coms, we're doing Five Boss Bitch Romantic Comedies, which is a great title for a show, so I thank you for that.
Very welcome.
Brackets, just for people to qualify it, give a bit of detail. Rom-coms featuring savvy women who follow their dreams and get their man too.
Exactly. And it would have been their woman too if there were really any good lesbian rom-coms, but there aren't yet. And hopefully someone will hear this and decide to make one.
Indeed. So before we go into that, you're an author and a filmmaker. Do you want to tell us a bit about work you've been doing and where you are at the moment?
Sure. So as far as the author goes, I have written 5 books and have yet to be published. I'm looking to go for the traditional publishing route, which is a long and arduous trail full of spreadsheets of like 250 rejections. But every rejection I get, people say, oh, this is great. I just don't know if if it's for me to make or to publish. And that's the creative life. I write young adult thrillers as my novels. And then in a larger leap, in my film and other media work, because I'm currently working on an audio rom-com series.
Oh, wow.
Which the pilot's out. And the other episodes will start. I'm actually recording the next episode in a couple weeks.
So what's that? What's that called then? Your audio rom-com?
Oh, it's called How to Fall in Love the Hard Way, And it is very much in line with this boss bitch theme. It's about 3 women who form an unlikely friendship, And through their friendship, conquer career goals and figure out their hang-ups about love. And there's a lot of fun, sexy scenes and a lot of fighting the man to get what they need at work, and how self-discovery helps inspire creative work in there as well, which I know I'm going to be talking about later when we get to one of our last film that is on the list.
Brilliant. How can people listen to that audio?
So it is available on any podcast platform you can imagine: Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Just search How to Fall in Love the Hard Way. Or if you want to go to the source, you can go to listen.howtofallinlovethehardway.com.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to make that really easy for people. And we'll get right into it. Now, before we do, I'll explain the rules of the game, because it is a bit of a game, even though it's very serious what we're going to talk about at the same time. Serious with a little S, not a big S. excuse me. This follows on from my format of Five Great Everything, 5. And with that, it's 5 films in 5 minutes. And as I've already said, we're doing 5 Boss Bitch Romantic Comedies with Paige. And at the end of 5 minutes, you and Paige will hear the sound of a barking dog. And that is a simulation of what will eventually be Pig, which is a French bulldog owned by my friend Dan. He has promised me the MP3 of the dog barking. So one day, this show will feature Pig. But for now, that is the noise we will hear at the end of 5 minutes. Does that seem clear to you, Paige?
That's very clear. I'm excited to get going.
Cool. Well, before we do, you in your notes to me, which are very helpful, you said you had your bonus choice, which isn't really a romantic comedy, but more a movie about family and self-discovery with a secondary plot, is Gene of the Joneses. Now, now that didn't quite make the list. So what is it about that you wanted to draw attention to before we get into your five?
So Gene of the Joneses it's just such a wonderful comedy about family and coming of age as a person, as a woman in your 30s.
Does Daphne still live here?
Grandma!
Sir?
I feel kind of funny.
Sad?
No, not sad, just funny.
Who is that man?
Who?
The man that died on our front step.
He's got a lot of nerve dying on my doorstep.
Is he ours?
Were you guys close?
What kind of man was he?
Was he a modest sort of man, or was he more ostentatious?
I don't know.
Are you going back to Jeremiah?
What?
You should. I'm not sure who else will marry you.
You're seeing someone.
It's tricky.
Tricky?
Dean is not marrying the Ken doll big American dream boyfriend. He's a rat.
Now we can all be single.
I have a husband.
There's a lot of expectations about when you turn 30. Mm-hmm. I'm 36, and that entire year for me was full of what the hell am I doing with my life? And because you should have life figured out by then. That's kind of the narrative that's put forth. And Gene of the Joneses explores that through a woman who's kind of going through a bit of a quarter life, third life crisis, depending on, you know, age, how old we're all going to live.
Yeah.
And she has to deal with her family, who's kind of loud and in your face. And it very much reminded me of conversations with my own family. And she also meets a guy and she's not sure where the relationship's going, but he's really nice. And she's also figuring out what she wants to do in her life, what she's passionate about, independent of that loud, bossy family who's trying to get her to do certain things. It is really just a wonderful comedy about self-discovery with romance in it. And it is, I saw it, I used to be a development executive. I saw it in Toronto when it premiered at the film festival, and it lit a fire in me. And I knew then that was the type of feeling that I wanted to give people from my writing, a sense of feeling like they belonged in a world, even if they didn't know where they belonged, and a sense of not being alone. And the funny family scenes, which are fantastic. And director Stella Meggy, who you might know better from The Photograph with Issa Rae and Lakeith Stanfield. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend checking out all of her work, because it really is all about self-discovery with a hint of romance.
I think your point is something interesting that film is very good at, which is obviously showing, but also able to say out loud the things that we might all be worried about or concerned about or not. Thinking hasn't quite turned out how we thought it was when we read the books as kids. And film does that perfect thing of being able to cut through and go, this is my problem. I'm having a crisis about this. And then we explore that as an idea of what makes us happy, what perceptions of what life being happy might look like. And that's a good thing, isn't it, about film?
Yeah, 100%. It's like therapy, except the tickets are way cheaper than therapy.
Well, look, let's jump in then with your five choices. Five boss bitch romantic comedies, and I'm looking forward to this one. I'm going to start the clock on His Girl Friday from 1940, directed by Howard Hawks.
Well, well. How long is it?
How long is what?
You know what. How long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda, about 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
Oh, no, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Yes, I would. I'd know you anytime,
any place. Anywhere. You're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I know this. You still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
His Girl Friday is almost a throwback in a way to films before the Hollywood Code era. The Hollywood Code is something I wrote a dissertation on it for my law degree. Mm-hmm. So this is my jam. So the Hollywood Code created was a censorship device that allowed studios to keep control of the content of their movie in a way, because Congress was threatening to create a whole censorship board, which would have been terrible. But because of it, there were a lot of things from the pre-code era from 1933 and before that were on screen that were no longer allowed on screen. And one of those things from that pre-code era was actually the women were more empowered, in control, in charge, and generally more active characters in those pre-code films.
That's one of the changes. Wow.
So there was, I watched a movie called Red Dust with Clark Gable, and I forget the lead actress's name, but she was living in a Central American, South American jungle area and was running her own business there. And there were always hints of kind of, she's a madam. There's a lot of hints of this woman is a madam, but you know, they were owning their stuff. Once the code happened, it started creating this image of women as subservient, of needing a man, wanting to be married, and there were less of these empowering, interesting tales. And Rosalind Russell here in His Girl Friday, it almost feels like a commentary on the fact that women were not expected to be empowered and in charge in the same way anymore, because she comes in with Ralph Bellamy, who is her fiance, and she's like, okay, I want a house in the suburbs and I want a baby and I just want to get married and not work. But then she spends the whole movie working and the whole movie saying, but I just want a normal life, when really it's clear she doesn't want a normal life.
Right,
And my film theory nerd side is very turned on by all of this, because it's just so intertextual, especially for a film of the time when that wasn't such a thing. When at a certain point, Rosalind Russell says, hey, there's a man on the street. He looks like that actor, Ralph Bellamy, who is the one who's playing her fiance, the actual actor. And Cary Grant talks about, name drops Archie Leach, and Archie Leach is his actual real name.
Right.
So there's a lot of fun little film theories nuggets in there. And then the thing that I love, love, love is the overlapping dialogue. And everyone talks over each other a mile a minute, and somehow you can still understand everything that's happening, and you get all the important parts, and there's just such this rhythm and patter and sense of excitement that this movie could so easily be a stage play, because it's in just a 2-3 locations the whole time, and the camera barely moves, but it just sits there, and this rhythm and energy from the dialogue gets you tense. And it's something that I aspire to in my writing. If you listen to the How to Fall in Love the Hard Way, you'll hear lots of back and forth, quick, 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 some overlap.
What do you think that does for drama then? What is it? What is the power of that for you?
Like I said, it creates a tension. There's an urgency there when people are speaking over another. There's also a sense of camaraderie, because you're gonna let people finish speaking if you don't know them very well. But if you know someone, you not only feel comfortable interrupting them, but you also know what they're going to say. They don't have to finish a sentence. So the overlapping dialogue, I think, and that kind of comes back to the movie, because whenever Ralph Bellamy gets interrupted, it's so someone else can say something to someone else. It's not because they're listening to him, but when Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell overlap.
Go finish your thought.
When Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell overlap, it's because they're talking to each other. And so that's the sexual tension too.
And obviously that, instead of fisticuffs, it's verbal blows, isn't it? You're trading.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's so funny. It's just, there's so many jokes. It's like Shakespeare.
Well, as that barking dog would suggest, we're moving on to the second choice of your five, which is, we're jumping 19 years now. So the Hollywood Code is is in full effect. Is it in full effect now at this point?
It's actually been weakened at this point. There's been Psycho in 1960 will sort of create a precedent that you don't need to follow it because it was never a law. It was always just you had to get a certificate from the code in order to be able to be shown in theaters because theater owners would refuse to show non-code films. There was a bit of a mafia feeling behind it. And then as people got, as foreign films became more popular, as people became looser with things, it all, the theater owners would maybe show a non-code film because the foreign films didn't necessarily need to have it. And then the code office would say, all right, we'll let you get away with more and more and more. And then Psycho in 1960 kind of just blew everything up because
that's really interesting.
I forget if they didn't have a certification or if the certification was kind of just, okay, we'll give it to you because you're Hitchcock.
Yeah. Well, I think the two films that came out at the time, you had Peeping Tom and Psycho. And
right.
And I think Peeping Tom almost ruined someone's career. And whereas it had laid the ground then for what Psycho then walked into, which is this, well, we didn't all die watching Peeping Tom. So maybe we'll be okay. But let's talk about your choice. So as a snapshot then of that time, what does Pillow Talk from 1959, directed by Michael Gordon, do then that his Girl Friday wasn't doing?
So Pillow Talk is, while the code is kind of being weakened, Pillow Talk is very much within the line of this 1950s, 1960s almost ideal of womanhood, where you at the end, she, even though Doris Day is playing this high-powered interior designer who works with just the best types of people, as soon as Rock Hudson says, you're my bride, she's suddenly willing to drop everything, including all of her grievances against him, and go to his bed.
Why, Miss Morrow? I was expecting Mr. Perrault.
Mr. Perrault is unavailable at this time. However, if you'd rather wait until he's free.
Oh, no, no. You'll do just fine. Please come in. It's just that it's a little embarrassing.
Mr. Allen, I'm a decorator, you a client. I'm here because you are paying for my professional services. Now, what style did you have in mind?
Nothing in particular. I'm leaving that entirely up to you.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I do my work. living room. Over here is kitchen, a dining room, over there.
And up here?
The bedroom.
And there are lots of beds in this movie, which is interesting and different. It is a very, very sexy film for this era, especially. You have, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's based on the concept of a party line, which is when the phone company couldn't keep up with the demands for telephones. They would give two people the same line, essentially, and you would have to share it. And Rock Hudson spends all his time seducing women on the phone, and Doris Day gets fed up with it. And so they have this whole back and forth where you're going to be like, I get a half hour, you get a half hour, and we'll switch every half hour. And then Rock Hudson sees her, sees that she's attractive, and figures out that she is his boss slash friend's love interest. And the boss slash friend is Tony Randall, is a millionaire, and it's hysterical. And he decides, okay, I'm gonna try to seduce her. This will be fun. And so he calls her up on their party line. There's like a code to dial each other. And they spend most of their courtship like talking on the phone. At one point, they're both in a bathtub together and they have their feet up on the wall and it's a split screen. And like it looks like he's stroking her foot with his foot. And then the fabulous Thelma Ritter plays this drunk housekeeper for Doris Day. And she's just walking around saying, basically, you need to get laid to Doris Day. Doris Day's a good girl. She's like, she's a good girl, but also she's like, I don't have bedroom problems. Then she keeps thinking about whether she has bedroom problems. So it's very risque while also being with the mores of the area of the area.
Did it cause consternation when it was released in turn? Because obviously Rock Hudson and Doris Day are bona fide stars in 1959, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think so. This was the first movie that they did together, if I am reading my my research correctly.
Yeah.
And it won her an Oscar for Best Actress, and it won Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars.
Okay.
It's very self-aware. There's a lot of inner monologues being not externalized, but it's voiceover inner monologue for everyone. And you know, Doris Day and Rock Hudson go to a piano bar and the pianist says, "Hey, why don't you sing a verse to Doris Day?" And she hands her the music and Doris and Rock sing together. And they look like they're just the best of friends. It's fantastic. Look like they had a great time making this movie.
What is it about her character then for you that makes you sort of put her under the banner of the boss bitch in a romantic comedy? What is she doing that's making her so strong?
Well, she's very secure in her life. She is single. She goes out with interesting men. Mm-hmm. She's an interior designer. She works for the best clients. She gets the moves put on her by a client's son in a very uncomfortable scene that these days it's hashtag Me Too all over the place. He
really?
Basically blackmails her into going to get a drink with him, or he's going to continue to force himself on her in his car when he's supposed to be taking her home. And so she's very firm in her belief. She's not interested in just getting married to get married. And she has, whenever someone says, when Rock Hudson tells her that she has bedroom problems, she's like, "I don't have bedroom problems. Everything's fine in my bedroom." She never has sex on camera, but she goes like, there's an implication that she's a single woman who gets it on, and that's great. And even though she is this very like pure sort of figure, this is a sex comedy pretty much without any sex, except in the bathtub scenes and things. It's an interesting like precursor to a sexual liberation.
Well, that dog barking tells us we're about to jump into the sexual beyond the sexual liberation with Mike Nichols' 1988 film Working Girl, which is very much about the late second half 20th century life of, get into the heart of what was perceived to be the independent woman, the business suit, the boxy shoulder pads, kicking ass just like the men. And in a way, you know, it's like, and I nearly said it myself, and he said it already, but it's like, it is almost like Just Like the Men is almost like the kind of thing that's going along with this. So what is it, what for you is Working Girl saying?
So Working Girl to me it's a really relevant movie even today. It's this woman who is, and it's more relevant today in terms of the class issues that it presents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like obviously the gender issues. So Tess is a secretary from Long Island who has a really good head for business. And she also says she has a bod for sin.
A great line. It's
fantastic. And it could have been such a terrible line, but Melanie Griffith is just flawless.
Do I look like I don't belong here?
No. No, I'm sure you're a real ace at whatever it is that you do.
Damn straight.
But how you look.
I have a head for business and a bod for sin. Is there anything wrong with that?
No.
She went to night school for 5 years to get her degree. She wants to get into the executive entree program. She knows stocks. She reads the newspaper and makes interesting connections between things she reads. She's super creative and super intelligent, but because she doesn't have the pedigree or the breeding or the look or the penis, she cannot get ahead. Mm. And when her, you know, when one of her bosses says, oh, you can meet with this guy, Bob from Arbitrage, it turns out it's a in a very prescient role. It's Kevin Spacey in a limo making her watch porn and saying that they're going to go party together. And Tess knows exactly what's happening right away. And she pours champagne on him and gets out on the side of the road in the middle of the rain in New York City. Mm. And so she's savvy and she really, really wants to be in business and to succeed in business. And she has this one last chance and she is working for a woman who's Sigourney Weaver, who is just classic. And she has the Miranda Priestley from Devil Wears Prada, that entrance. Before that entrance,
I was going to say there's definitely shades of Devil Wears Prada in this movie.
Oh, 100%. And like, this is also like Devil Wears Prada was not a romantic comedy, but this movie similarly has
springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Like the romantic storyline, the storyline between Tess and Jack, who's Harrison Ford, he just sparkles in this movie. It's almost secondary. Tess needs the deal that she comes up with this deal based on things she read in the paper and the society pages and the business pages. And she figures out that Sigourney Weaver, who said, I'm going to help you, is actually undermining her. And she says, screw it. I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to contact the person that Catherine, that Sigourney Weaver is contacted, and we're going to do it together. And she just fakes it till she makes it. She figures out that she needs to change her hair, to change her makeup, to change her clothing. And once she gets the look right, and once she sounds right, she's able to just kind of walk in and put things together using her natural smarts. And it's not even a case of like street smarts versus book smarts, because she has both, but she also has like a fire in her belly, which is one of the lines in the movie.
It's interesting. It's interesting your breakdown of the film, because traditionally, you know, from looking from UK to America, the idea of a class system is very much something that's seen as a very much a British trope. But what you're describing with, and you use the term breeding and obviously needing to moderate Melanie Griffith's character, having to change her voice and her look. These are all very superficial things, which are nothing to do with genuine qualities. They're all about fitting in with what's acceptable to move on, aren't they? And fitting in with a general flow of stuff, which is a barrier that you get with the British class system all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And I think that the setting for this movie in New York City, where she's from, I think Staten Island, and Sigourney Weaver's from Manhattan. Mm. There's that's a huge class divide. There's discernible accents that happen in the outer boroughs of New York that don't necessarily happen in Manhattan. And so I think this is one of the place, like if this could also have been set in Nashville and you would have had a similar thing where you have this, like, you know, instantly from looking at someone how much money they make, where they come from. And there's certain markers of class, even without all that, that you can, or at least in New York, I mean, now with Silicon Valley people wearing t-shirts and hoodies and stuff, that's a whole different.
I think it's an interesting part of what is essentially a sort of, I guess, a steely-eyed kind of rom-com in a sense, because the way that Melanie Griffith's character has got to move forward is about going toe-to-toe. So she knows, like in that great line that you said before, that she can get any man she wants because of the rules of attraction. But that doesn't work in her favor all the time in terms of what she wants to do in terms of business. And that's the thing that's not on her terms, isn't it? So then she has to, her character has to adapt. And then, like you say, part of her street smarts is what actually becomes part of her overall strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And I learned so much from this movie. I learned to read everything, to make connections between, you know, get ideas that way. I learned about elevator pitches from this movie. It was very formative for me just in, you know, life.
It's interesting because 1988 is obviously a long, is what we're talking now, 33 years ago from now. Yeah. And this film was presented, I mean, in a way, and it's interesting looking at Harrison Ford's character as the kind of, as the male in this, not just from a romantic point of view, but just in terms of the business setting, because his character is effortless, because in 1988, in the business world you're orbiting, his status was not under threat. There's a relaxed attitude in everything he does because there's no challenge to it. It's either does he get the woman he wants or does he not? That's his biggest threat. Whereas Melanie's got a big 360 problem in her life.
Exactly. Yeah, he's sort of her foil, even though he says, I haven't had a hit in a while, but he's not really, and I don't want to be a little piece of tape that's just someone that is going to come and replace me at my job. Like there's this attempt at finding a threat, but really the story's not about him succeeding. It's all about her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right then, we're going to jump into the 21st century for your next choice.
Yes.
It's interesting because we've had in terms of me looking at how IMDb describes the movies as a little summary, we've had Ace Reporter Ex-Wife, we've had Interior Decorator, we've had a secretary whose ideas get stolen. Now we've got a character who's described as an arrogant career woman in 2001 with Two Can Play That Game. So do you want to talk us through what it is that appeals to this in terms of the five boss bitch romantic comedies?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite movies and one that very few people have seen, at least in my acquaintance. It is basically an all-black cast with the exception of Ray Wise. And it is directed by a black director, written by a black writer. And so I feel like I want to point that out because I feel like the word arrogant would not have been chosen if this was an all-white cast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's kind of my subtext to saying it even.
Yeah. And so Vivica Fox plays Shantae, who is this like marketing guru. She's the youngest partner at her firm. She is black. She is proud of that. She is really she is in control. And she knows that she's better than everyone because she had to be to get there.
Shantae, isn't there Keith over there on the dance floor? I thought you said he was working late.
Damn, girl. What you gonna do?
I'm gonna go over there and say hey. I'll be right back.
Hey!
Vaughn, no good son of a bitch! Oh!
I can't believe you lied to me.
What kind of bullshit is that?
No, she gonna handle business. She'll handle it.
Get it together, Shantae. Get it together. Get it together.
Okay, this is where the rules begin. If you ever find yourself in a situation like this, rule number one, never panic. Stay cool. Act like it doesn't bother you one bit. And address the issue head on.
We all want the high life, big cheese in the spotlight. Rocking the cordless mics in the hot light.
Hey, big cheese, I thought that was you. What's up?
Hey, look, this is,
I'm Shantae. I'm sorry.
Hey.
Is that DKNY?
Yes, it sure is.
Oh, girl, cute. Oh,
thank you, girl.
Nice to see you, Keith. Talk to you soon.
She was nice. Who's she?
Don't cause a scene. Don't go off. In situations like this, less is always best.
So I talked a little bit about breaking the fourth wall in Pillow Talk. This entire movie is her breaking the fourth wall. She turns to the camera and says, like, this is who I am. I have a great man. I have a great life. Everything's perfect. My friends are amazing. They all have their problems, and they also all come to me when they have their problems. And let me tell you, I can solve them. And so she has a whole system for how to keep your man in line. And she goes like, so her boss bitchness is just inherent in her character. Mm. And this whole movie is basically, how do you handle a relationship when it's maybe going off the rails? If something's happening that you don't like, what do you do? And this is, the whole movie is an instruction manual for how to take charge of a situation. And then when the situation doesn't work, it's about also being vulnerable and stopping playing games. So it's just so much fun. There's like hot cars, there's parties, there's and like one thing that the previous films really missed, with the exception of Joan Cusack and Working Girl, who is just astonishingly amazing, is a solid group of friends for the lead woman. Mm. And this movie, Shantae is with her friends a lot of her figuring out what to do about her relationship is just, all right, so on this day, you're just going to go hang out with your friends. You just have a good time. And they do. And there's no threat. Like, the friends aren't really foils for her. Mm. They have their own lives. They have their own stories. They're not the threat like Sigourney Weaver. They're just cool people that she loves. And that's really refreshing in a genre that tends to view other women as the enemy.
I mean, it's written and directed by Mark Brown, who wrote Barbershop a year later, or film exactly. Came out a year. I'm not sure he wrote it a year later, but Barbershop came out a year later. How do you think he tackles her as a female character from a writing point of view? What is he doing right, I suppose?
That's a tough question, because this isn't as much of a typical character as it is like Vivica Fox being this infomercial saleswoman for the lifestyle that she has.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, obviously this is his writing, but it's so much her performance and her selling herself as someone in charge. I also feel like he must also know a bunch of really badass women, because it all feels so true to me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the bottom
line.
Yeah,
and that's kind of important, I think. If it feels true, yeah, then there's no reason to believe that it's not coming from a true point of view.
Right. There's like little breaking the fourth wall things in this about romantic comedies. Like, so the plan that she's doing to make her man stay in line involves, like, on this day, do this. If he does that, if he responds this way, then do this. And one of the things she has to do is she chooses essentially a Bellamy, which is the basically a patsy, someone who is nice enough, but it's not right for the main character, not right for the love interest, not right to be a love interest for your main character in a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Part of her plan is, all right, you got to go choose someone. You can't be too good looking. You can't be too suave, but he can't be terrible either. And that's exactly what a Bellamy is. And you let him hug him, and you make sure that someone sees you be all up on him, and then tells your man about it. And it's just so fun. I just love this movie.
No, I think that's very clear. I think that's very clear, no doubt, Paige. Right then. We're gonna move 10 years on into Beyond the Noughties now. So in the decade that we've just left, 2011's music and lyrics, written and directed by Mark Lawrence. Do you want to talk us through this one?
Sure, absolutely. So first of all, it's a movie about music, and the soundtrack is phenomenal. It's both satirical and true. The song that brings our two love interests together was written by Adam Schlesinger, who, rest in peace, he COVID got him.
Oh, wow.
Earlier last year. He also wrote That Thing You Do and Stacey's Mom, the Fountains of Wayne song. So he's just an incredible talent who has left us way too soon.
Oh,
and
sad to hear that.
It, Yeah, it's this movie should have been nominated for multiple Oscars for songwriting. It's a fun romp. It also has a lot to say about songwriting and the creative process.
Without a doubt. That's an important part, isn't it? How organic that is, which obviously is a metaphor for relationships.
Exactly. And the thing that's nice about this is that there's, between the love interests, there's a bit of, it's not just about the woman. So this movie is about Sophie, who is played by Drew Barrymore, learning to step into her own power and finding her creative voice after it was stifled by this terrible ex-boyfriend professor man that she dated and who basically wrote a fictionalized, villainized version of her. And it became this crazy, huge bestseller. And Alex, who's played by Hugh Grant, is this faded pop star who doesn't believe that he has anything worthwhile to say. And instead of like in Working Girl, where Jack was kind of secure and Tess was not, both Alex and Sophie need each other to make each other better. The song that they're writing is going to heal both of them. And so this dual growth is really something that I love about this. And the fact that in order to overcome their creative blocks, they have to open up to each other, which leads them to being in a relationship because they were honest with each other in order to produce something.
Now, vocals. No, you see, you have to sing into the microphone. It won't follow you.
But I can't.
It's a duet for a man and a woman. We are as close as we've got.
Your headphones
and a level. You look nice in those. You should wear them all the time.
How is that?
Yes?
Okay!
Shh, shh, shh.
It's okay.
And way back into love. Take one.
No. Oh, God. I'm getting really nervous.
You'll be fine. You just use your normal, nice voice that I've heard so much of in the last 3 days.
It's like, my throat's closing up. It's like anaphylactic.
It's fine. It's just a 3-minute song. Just a little bit louder, because this song is intended for humans, okay? Way back into love, take two.
This is about like how being sensitive and being open and emotional and vulnerable can make you this huge boss. And
I guess, yeah, because in a sense, owning vulnerability is a bit more of a shield than succumbing to it. If that's not an oxymoron to describe it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's with just going back to that, the thing about creativity, there's reasons for them to be talking about these things, because all of these old wounds are things that can help find inspiration and also can help you feel safe sharing ideas. It's not just the classic, oh, I'm going to tell you all my deep, dark secrets because I now trust you. It's more, all right, we got to work. And at one point, Hugh Grant says, all right, we don't have time to do this. You need to tell me what's going on. You need to tell me why you're so freaked out right now. And then Sophie Drew Barrymore says, yeah, okay, yes, I do. I will. And she tells him this whole, her whole backstory. And he's really supportive about it. And he helps build her up so that she can overcome it. And that's, it's just such a sweet relationship where they both need each other, which is something that's not necessarily as, His Girl Friday of these five movies is actually the relationship that mimics this the most, because Cary Grant needs his best writer, needs his ex-wife, and he keeps trying to make her stay as much as she's trying to leave to go on her to go get married.
Yeah, you're right, because in a sense the rom-com is often blighted by the fact that it's about someone getting someone as opposed to two people needing each other.
Yes, exactly. And the relationship works because they've been able to grow together. They've been able to both, like, Alex becomes a bad bitch too, a boss bitch. He no longer is sitting on his past laurels of fame, just hoping that he can make it one day to the next. He has a creative spark again.
I've not seen it. So does it obey the kind of the narrative rules of attraction, repel, or does it operate on a different level?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's very textbook romantic comedy. They have their meet cute at the very beginning, and then they see each other again. They come together. They have their one perfect day. They break up. They try to get back together. They don't. Big grand gesture and happy ever after.
Fantastic. Well, as Pig just back in there, we've reached the end of our five boss bitch romantic comedies. I'm just going to recap so people can get a list of the titles in one fell swoop. So we've just covered His Girl Friday from 1940, directed by Howard Hawks; Pillar Talk 59, directed by Michael Gordon; Working Girl 88, directed by Mike Nichols; Two Can Play That Game 2001, directed by Mark Brown; and Music and Lyrics 2011, directed by Martin Lawrence. It's really interesting, sort of, because the idea, it's always about the working woman element is an important part, and that striving to be the independent person first that then has a relationship after is what's running through all these films. And if it's and often the older films, I guess, is if I give myself to a man, then I'm giving up part of what this thing is that's made me independent. And that's an interesting dramatic thing that's changed. Even as soon as 88 with Working Girl, that the story is, it's not a job or a man, is it, at that point?
No. It's she gets the man because she has the job.
Yeah, yeah.
Or because she wanted the job.
Yeah. And then by Two Can Play That Game and Music and Lyrics, we're just talking about adults having relationships and how they go right and wrong. And in a sense, exactly. What happens, what do you do when they go wrong? And then how do you fix it? And can you fix it? And who do you need to help you fix it? And how relationships grow out of the trust that comes from somebody supporting you, as opposed to the kind of traditional, I'm going to date you, I'm going to court you, I'm going to seduce you, which is it doesn't feel like that'd be right anymore in terms of how to present the kind of the ideas of the laws of attraction anymore. You know, I'm going to save this person from themselves by making them part of me.
Yes, exactly. And I would like to give one final thought on His Girl Friday.
Certainly.
So when I rewatched all of these before recording, and one thing that struck me about His Girl Friday is that it has the same plot as Twister, the Helen Hunt, Bill Paxton movie.
No way.
Yes. So in Twister, it's gender flipped. A man and a woman who used to be married or who are almost divorced, who used to work together, are the man comes back and says, hey, honey, I need you to sign the divorce papers because I'm engaged and we're just about to get off getting married. And then a giant work event happens, which is a tornado, which sidelines the whole thing and allows them to rekindle their relationship. Such a fantastic movie. And same plot, it stole their plot from His Girl Friday, except there are more cows.
Yeah, no. Now you've said it. It's interesting. It is. Yeah, I'd never thought of it as following like a rom-com thing, but now you've said it, it's bloody obvious. Well, look, let's remind people what's the name of your audio rom-com that you're producing and developing?
So it is called How to Fall in Love the Hard Way, and it is available on all podcast platforms and also at listen.howtofallinlovethehardway.com. The pilot is out now, and episodes 2 through 10 will be coming later this year.
Fantastic. Well done on that. And thank you very much for lending us your thoughts on 5 Boss Bitch romantic comedies.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
It's always, this is what I love about this and having expanded the format to be whatever the guest wants to sort of wax lyrical about is it means I then end up watching films differently, not just these 5, but then other romantic comedies I'm going to tune into now. I'm going to be seeing some of these dynamics. The fact that you've already drawn a parallel with Twister, having rewatched His Girl Friday recently, is that, and I love that idea that the human story and relationships are one of the most universal truths that won't go away in a way.
Oh yeah. And it took me a long time to figure out that I wanted to write romantic comedies and write about romance, because I always enjoyed those parts of stories, but I never thought there's something inherently feminine and therefore societally says it's kind of inferior to just want to write about love, but really it's universal. It's in Twister. I love Twister because there's a love story in it, and I am not afraid to say it.
No, I think that's of all the unintended consequences of a podcast, that's one of my favorites to discover that. Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.